Major funding for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center.
The criminal law rests on a moral code, and the way you make a moral code effective and believable is by enforcing it. But that's only part of the puzzle. If you leave it at law enforcement, it simply turns the problem of criminality into a game of cat and mouse. Can I get away with it or not? To deal with the causes of criminality, you have to deal with the way in which the human personality is formed.
Well, there are different ways in which popular culture has been used. Certainly historians in the past have tended to use it to describe the culture of the lower classes versus the high culture of the elites, based on books on the great ideas of great thinkers. But it tends to lose some of the characteristics that historians impute to it, namely that it represents a localized culture, something which takes place within very limited geographical horizons.
Criminality and consumer culture, two conversations this week on Soundings. First, a discussion with James Q. Wilson about crime and human nature. Following that, a discussion about consumer culture. My guests will be Keith Luria of North Carolina State University and Jean-Christophe Agnew of Yale University. James Q. Wilson teaches at the University of California at Los Angeles. Among his books are Thinking About Crime and, with Richard J. Hernstein, Crime and Human Nature. Here is James Q. Wilson.
There is a genetic component in all forms of human behavior, whether it's music or art or athletic performance or our own personality. And crime is no different. There is a genetic factor that influences our personality and thus influences the extent to which we are impulsive or restrained, extroverted or introverted. There is a genetic factor that influences our intelligence and thus our ability to foresee the distant consequences of present actions or to internalize society's rules. Genetics is not the whole story. There's no such thing as a born criminal. But there is a genetic component in crime.
Aren't we, after all, left with a sort of Joseph Conrad Heart of Darkness thesis when we look at instances, as we record this conversation, Jim Wilson, in the spring of 1989, we've got this horrible case in the news, this pack of teenagers, the newspapers called them, in New York City, attacking a jogger late at night and for no apparent reason, just doing some awful, horrible things. Are we left with this sort of mystery of human evil explanation?
Well, right now it's a mystery because, alas, scholars interested in criminology have not worked as hard as they should have to unravel a mystery. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of methodological and ideological reasons why they haven't looked as hard. To unravel the mystery requires us, with respect to criminality, to do exactly the same thing we have to do to understand any other form of human behavior, to learn how the human personality is shaped in the family in the early years of life. That can be done. It is very difficult to do. We have not begun yet to do it.
What about the other side of the coin, Jim Wilson? That is to say, we want to look at the strengthening factors, the elements that appear to offset the criminal behavior or criminal predisposition. You mentioned family values, religious values, values that as a culture we agree on. Are these forceful enough that in the long run we can say, well, they will prevail? Or is that really an act of faith and hope to say so?
Well, there's some preliminary evidence that the right kind of preschool education, the right kind of education, the right kind of peer group relationships can make an important difference. Religion is a more problematic case. It would stand to reason, you would think, that a religious society would provide support for factors that strengthen self-control and weaken impulsiveness. And yet, if we look at the industrial nation that has the lowest crime rate by far, it is Japan, which is, by the standards of Western conceptions of religiosity at least, the least religious of all nations. It doesn't believe in divine revelation. It does not have a view about predestination. It does not believe that God will sit in judgment and reward people either with heaven or hell. And if we look at countries such as Latin America, where the crime rate is the highest, we see a Catholic church there that is heavily influential, where many people are not only pro forma Catholics, but practicing Catholics, and yet the level of crime is very high.
Let's talk comparatively, Jim Wilson. How tough are Americans about crime, on criminals?
That's a harder question to answer than many people think. It is quite true that we have a higher proportion of our population in prison than is true of virtually any other civilized nation in the world. But that doesn't mean that we are tough on crime, because we do not know what proportion of criminals are imprisoned. It may be that we're not as tough as other nations. It may be, and I have seen some evidence to this effect, that in England and even in Japan, the probability of a serious crime resulting in imprisonment is greater than the probability of the same crime in this country resulting in prison. We have a prison population of 500,000, several hundred thousand more in jails, and many more millions on probation. But whether this represents an overreaction to a crime problem or an underreaction to crime problem cannot be said from available data.
What about set against, for example, the Islamic countries, the Arab countries, that they catch a thief and wham, the hand comes off, that sort of thing?
Well, that's the mythology. In fact, it's very hard to find any severed hands lying around the squares of Muslim cities. It seems to be the exception rather than the rule. I think it's probably fair to say that in Muslim nations, the criminal sanction may fall more heavily. But the key question is, what is the probability of it falling given any criminal act? We don't know the answer to that question. Mm-hmm. We don't even have a reasonable guess at it.
What about drug trafficking? Let's turn our attention to that, Jim Wilson. It's difficult to put this on the table because it appears to be such a serious problem. Are we overreacting? Do we really have the problem that we hear about and read about in the media all the time? Is it so horrible by comparison, with the opium trade in the 19th century?
Oh, it's far worse. It's far worse, not because the nation as a whole is suffused in drugs, by drugs such as cocaine and crack. As a matter of fact, there is evidence that among most people, the level of experimentation and continued use of dangerous drugs has stabilized or declined over the last several years. We have a more serious problem because people at risk, essentially inner city populations, are now having made available to them drugs at a much more affordable cost, with much less risk of apprehension or punishment than once was the case, so that we have whole neighborhoods in our cities that are being destroyed by the drug trade in a way that was not true when Thomas De Quincey wrote Confessions of an Opium Eater.
Where do we look for, maybe answers is too strong a word, but suggestions, observations, Jim Wilson, that you would bring to this problem? Do we look at education? Do we look at law enforcement, a mixture? What elements have I not?
Well, surprisingly enough, there's a great deal of consensus about what we should look at among law enforcement people and treatment specialists. And the answer can be expressed in two words: demand reduction. There must, of course, be law enforcement to break up drug trafficking rings and to discourage people from attempting to sell it on the streets. But I don't know of any serious police chief in the United States who doesn't believe that that's a stopgap measure, that unless we reduce the demand for this substance, the problem is unmanageable. Now, we did do that with heroin. We forget that we have brought the heroin epidemic of the 1970s under control. And we did it by first making it clear to heroin users how dangerous it was, that you could kill yourself, and the word slowly got around. Secondly, we made heavy use of a synthetic opiate called methadone, which blocks the heroin high, but also blocks the withdrawal pains that come from the abstinence from heroin use. And we did it by continued law enforcement pressure on smuggling networks. And we did it by a testing program, especially in the military, that simply made it impossible to stay in the military if you had dirty urine. Now, we cannot apply quite the same strategy with cocaine and crack because there is no equivalent to methadone for cocaine. There is no pill that you can take. But there is no reason in principle why such a pill cannot be discovered. So that I suspect demand reduction, which is the key to the problem, is going to occur from self-education, noticing that a lot of people have destroyed their lives, continued law enforcement pressure that makes it clear that this is risky, the spread of testing, which will convince people that it is risky, and I hope some pharmacological strategy that will provide people a way with such that the euphoria produced by heroin is by cocaine is no longer available. This will take quite a while. It can be helped by education and treatment programs. I don't want to dismiss those, but those tend to reach a relatively small part of the population compared to the other strategies I was talking about.
Let's move toward a conclusion of our discussion, Jim Wilson. I've made reference, and you commented on the opium trade in the 19th century. Is the drug problem as we see it in late 20th century America, is it peculiar to our culture? Is this something that, in your view, as a historian, a commentator about crime, is this something that is going to recur and poke its ugly head up in other forms?
Oh, certainly.
Can we get rid of it?
We cannot get rid of the addictive tendencies in the human personality. And we can be addicted to food or sex or alcohol, tobacco, drugs, practically any source of reinforcement or rewards is potentially addictive. Now, the United States is not unique in this because human nature is not unique to the United States. If we look around the rest of the world, once the market opens, once the manufacturers have found out a way to produce the product at a reasonable price, every nation experiences this problem. The United States experiences it in more acute form because individual freedom is more carefully safeguarded here, our borders are more open, and we have a more heterogeneous population. But we're not unique. We will see recurring bouts of addictive binges that depend ultimately simply on the ingenuity of those who invent and distribute drugs. And we will therefore periodically have to reconfront this question and allow the factors I mentioned earlier to work the demand reduction strategy for each new generation.
All right, quick footnote to our conversation, Jim Wilson. I understand that you're an academic, a scholar, a historian, and not a psychotherapist, but let me become personal for a moment. What would you say to the person who's got a problem, realizes that he or she is in a criminal position here with respect to drugs, to the parent who's trying to educate a kid, to the kid who realizes or may not realize that he or she is about to fall into this awful trap?
Well, I think that I would say two things. First, that some people are more at risk for addiction than others, and there's nothing you can do about that. Some alcoholism, for example, has a strong heritable component. Some people are more at risk to becoming addicted to alcohol than others. The second thing I would say is, apart from that predisposition, drug addiction tends to take the form of either emulating the parent's own behavior where the family is close, or rebelling against the parents when the family is not close. If it's the first case, the parents had better examine their own behavior. Are they drinking a lot and smoking a lot and taking weekend parties with marijuana? And if they are, do they really think the kids are not going to learn from that? Secondly, if the family isn't close, they better become close, because a child needs warmth, support, and caring. And if he's not going to get it from parents, he's going to get it from peer groups. And in those peer groups, to be counted one of the boys or one of the girls, you're going to be exposed to the drug trade.
James Q. Wilson teaches in the Graduate School of Management at the University of California at Los Angeles. He was a recent visitor at the National Humanities Center, where he participated in the center's seminar on political and social history. His books include Thinking About Crime and, with Richard J. Herrnstein, Crime and Human Nature. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Soundings on Contemporary Culture continues now with a discussion about the consumer society. My guests are Jean-Christophe Agnew of Yale University and Keith Luria of North Carolina State University. Jean-Christophe Agnew and Keith Luria both participated in a recent symposium on popular and public culture, which convened at North Carolina State University. Here is Jean-Christophe Agnew.
Well, I think for a long time, the understanding of consumer culture was largely a negative understanding, a critical understanding, and what has often been called a top-down understanding, the notion that anything produced for and within a consumer culture was by definition cheap or shoddy or vulgar or what have you, and to be distinguished from high culture. Mm-hmm. And I think the interest in coming at something, the interest at in consumer culture as popular culture is an interest in what people who were consumers actually made of the objects and the performances and the things that they bought, they purchased, rather than assuming or projecting into those purchases the meanings of cultural critics.
Uh-huh. It may not be a new idea, and I'm asking you to comment on whether you think it's a good one or a bad one. I've heard people in high places in our government talk about education now as a commodity, as something that parents go out and shop around for. Is that a good thing or a bad thing, that we think about something as intangible as an education in terms of consumerism and the consumer society? Keith, let me ask you to comment, and then we'll ask John Agnew.
Well, I think the natural tendency is to, because of what John Agnew said earlier about the sort of derogatory view of public culture that we have often held, our immediate impulse is to say it's bad. That may not be a very fair assessment. It's perhaps inevitable if, in fact, everything in a society has become commoditized, then it's hard to see any reason why education would remain apart from that. I don't know. I mean, to say whether I think it's good or bad, I guess I still sort of feel it's bad in some degree, but I think it's also perhaps inevitable.
Education, after all, is a part of our larger society, and if we think of this larger, of the whole in consumer terms, then it's inevitable that we're going to think about education that way. John Agnew?
Yes, it is. If I think about my own experience of teaching, we have at the beginning of every semester a two-week period where students can decide which course they want to register for.
And that's shopping around.
That's called shopping. There's a very strong consciousness of courses, for example, as consumer items. And in some ways, this can be empowering for students because they begin to think of themselves as educated consumers. In other ways, it has there's a tendency to make all courses look alike or to make them not to begin to see the connection between the material that's in one course and the material in another course. One is accumulating a knowledge in a kind of mechanical, quantitative way and losing a lot of other important aspects of knowledge at the same time.
A recent editorial in the Smithsonian Magazine where the Robert McCormick Adams, the secretary of the Smithsonian, writes that there's a difference between knowledge and information. Let me ask you to comment on a proposition, Keith Luria, John Agnew. One of our trustees here at the center in a recent meeting commented that, in a sort of public-private remark, you might say, that American business people are really very pessimistic about the future of this country. There's a sort of rhetoric of optimism. But what he's saying is that here the very group of people, the business community, which has produced in large measure this consumer culture that you two are talking about, is not optimistic about what it's going to do to us. He went so far as to say that we have a sort of death wish in this society. Now, that may be a little dramatic. Just let me ask you to comment on that, Keith.
Yeah, I think it is overly dramatic. I must admit I'm a little puzzled when I hear comments like that. I wouldn't want to say that the consumer culture that we live in is just produced by business people. I think we've talked here about a somewhat more interactive way of forming culture. It's not just produced by a small group. But it is a culture which, after all, helps both produce the products they want to produce and sell the products they want to sell. It's become a very sort of fashionable complaint to talk about how everything is sort of going down the tubes. But there's no question that things could be in many ways better than they are, but I guess I'm a little puzzled by the people who are doing the complaining.
How about this, John Agnew?
Well, one way in which that contradiction has been interpreted is to say that capitalism, which succeeded on the basis of the work ethic, has in a sense undermined or subverted itself by producing such a wealth of goods that it has, as a kind of byproduct of its success, produced a soft, self-indulgent population. And I think you can see that kind of reasoning operating in the various managerial manuals that point to Japan and the hard work ethic, the hard-working population that and culture that you find there, which is always juxtaposed to the high expectations, high consumer expectations of the American people. But I think what, again, historians most recently have shown, or certainly have argued, is that this connection between a work ethic and a consumer ethic, the notion of enjoying the good life, so to speak, is not one of a sequence. That is, where you have a work ethic in the 18th century, in the 19th century, followed by a consumer ethic that undermines capitalism in the 20th century, but that this double ethic, so to speak, existed from the get-go, existed from the 18th century onwards, and has always been operating in a kind of dualism.
Well, you've got these warring dimensions, and it's too easy to accept this invitation to categorize ourselves as either workers or sybarites of after a fashion. Let's move toward a conclusion of our conversation, John Agnew, Keith Luria. What about the relationship between the United States of America and the wider world when we talk about the consumer culture?
Well, actually, it reminds me of some years ago now, when I was studying in London, I read a letter to the editor of the Times one morning of a woman who had just returned from a trip to the United States, and she was writing into the Times to say how pleased she was to find that even in the United States she was able to buy her favorite product, namely Coca-Cola, and how extraordinary she thought that was. Now, I've always assumed that was a tongue-in-cheek letter, but I, in fact, am not positive about that, and I think it comments on two things. I mean, it's sort of a contradictory way of interpreting what she was talking about. One, obviously, that Coca-Cola, the great American product, is available everywhere. But it also speaks a lot to a certain remaining insularity. I mean, how could she not have known that Coca-Cola was an American product?
How dare she not know?
It seems sort of hard to believe in some respect. Right. I suspect that I'm not convinced, number one, that we want to just sort of do a better job of imposing American culture around the world. And second of all, I suspect that when we do, we find that, just as we find when historians study elite and popular culture, that the rest of the world is making use of it in its own way.
John Agnew?
For a long time, around the world, consumer culture was understood and called Americanism. And this is particularly true since World War II.
It got to be a dirty word.
Got to be very much a dirty word. And, for example, in post-war France, there was a great discussion about whether Coca-Cola would, in fact, be allowed into the country to really compete in terms of its bottling plants.
Not to mention the French language itself.
Exactly. Franglais was the main complaint, the way in which it had been corrupted by the imports of American language. But I think what we're beginning to discover, and it's very sobering to many Americans, is that consumer culture is international, and that in many ways the notion of public culture, at least as I understand it, is an effort to grasp that fact that it's an international language or idiom, consumer culture, so that we're purchasing Laura Ashley clothes and Sony stereos and so forth, with the result that this whole argument that I alluded to at the outset, between a sort of inauthentic and corrupt mass culture and an authentic folk and popular culture that gets displaced by it, is now being challenged by this vision of an international consumer culture that is multicultural and that will have its sort of hybridizing effects upon America as we begin to import more and more objects and performances and spectacles from the rest of the world.
Real quick footnote to our conversation, John Agnew and Keith Luria. Let's imagine for a moment that there is somebody out there who runs the culture, who invents consumer culture, whether they are captains of industry, leaders of education, however you want to characterize it. As scholars of popular culture, mass culture, consumer culture, what would you say to this person or group of persons about the nature and the direction of consumerism and popular culture? Do you presume to give advice, you scholars, when you analyze these things, or do you just let it go at being descriptive? Keith?
Well, I think I work on a far too remote a period of history to give advice, but I would suggest only that that when the symbol makers make their symbols and present them to the rest of us, they should be aware that what the rest of us are taking away are not necessarily what they intended always to begin with.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to a conversation about consumer culture. My guests were Jean-Christophe Agnew of Yale University and Keith Luria of North Carolina State University. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $4 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Ask for program number 467. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, a discussion about archaeology in 3rd century Roman Palestine. My guests will be Eric and Carol Myers of Duke University. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. The second week in September marks birthdays for the American writers William Sidney Porter, H.L. Mencken, and Sherwood Anderson, and for the British writers D.H. Lawrence and Agatha Christie. O. Henry was born during the second week in September 1862, H.L. Mencken in 1880, and Sherwood Anderson in 1876. D.H. Lawrence was born during mid-September 1885, Agatha Christie in 1890. Honduras gained its political independence from Spain in early September 1821. General Motors was established in mid-September 1908. Carrying 102 passengers, the Mayflower departed Plymouth, England, during the second week in September 1620. Finally, the only librarian ever hanged in effigy was born during mid-September 1797. Sir Anthony Panizzi, who became the principal librarian at the British Museum, was tried in absentia by an Austrian court for his political activity during the first part of the 19th century. Panizzi developed rules which form the basis of modern book cataloging. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation and from the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Crimes and Consumers. Two conversations this week on Soundings. James Q. Wilson of UCLA discusses his books, Crime and Human Nature, and Thinking About Crime. Jean-Christophe Agnew of Yale University and Keith Luria of North Carolina State University discuss the consumer society in America and the world. Crimes and Consumers, this week on Soundings.